The world today is insecure, and in more ways than one. Threats of terroristic attacks are constantly in the news, and although we may have become acclimatized to them, they still provoke anxiety. We can minimize the anxiety a bit by frequent contact with our loved ones, reassurance, and of course I suggest that when you take a plane trip, call home when you land. If your children have cell phones, let them know that they can call you at any time, even when you're at work. If you're in a situation where you can't talk, just say, "Honey, can't talk with you now, I'll talk to you later, I love you." Children and spouses should know where they can reach you. But this is really not our topic. We'll be addressing tonight the psychological security of our home in a chaotic world. Especially, how to provide our children with a feeling of security. You know, when I was growing up, there wasn't any need to discuss a topic like this. The world was a fairly decent place when I was a kid. I remember that as a six-year-old child, I was not allowed on the beach without a two-piece bathing suit. When President Truman once used the word hell in a speech, there was a national cry of outrage. I don't recall hearing anything about drugs or about adolescent suicide. Today, suicide is the third leading cause of death among adolescents. Today, every remnant of modesty has disappeared, and moral corruption occurs in the highest offices of the land. Our children are exposed to unprecedented violence, immorality, and corruption. And almost every day there is news of a missing child. Yes, some of these things occurred before, but we weren't made as aware of them. And right now the media is just looking for sensationalism and blasting away with all of these kinds of anxiety-provoking incidents. And by the way, if you need any further proof that things have changed, if you just look at here, I don't know if you can see it from there, but the Aron Kodesh, the Ark, has a lock. When I was a kid, the shul that we davened in had over 30 Torahs. The Ark was not locked. Nobody stole Torahs in those days. It's a different world. When I was a kid, there was such a thing as authority. And I remember, if we were told that we're going to be sent to the principal's office, principal's office! I'd rather face a firing squad. You know, one of the most shocking things in my life, I remember in grade school when the principal addressed the student body, Miss Ebbets. Tall, stately person. My idea of God at that time was he's almost as powerful as Miss Ebbets. But the shocking thing was when, as a third-year medical student, we could add a few bucks by doing physical exams at the hospital for chronically mentally ill. And so I'd come in, and they would give me a list of people who I were to examine. And then one day I came in, and on that list was Pauline Ebbets. And they wheeled in this old, broken, frail, demented woman who at one time was my idea of being superior to God. Yeah, this is over 50 years ago. And when I think of it, it still is a shocking experience. But that's what authority was. But today, There's defiance of authority. Principals are afraid of the students rather than the students being afraid of the principals. You know, more than once, I have contemplated disconnecting my phone and eliminating my email. The barrage of calls that I receive about problems of indecency and dishonesty and family disruption is becoming intolerable. 2 weeks ago, I had no answer for a mother whose 9-year-old child is viewing internet pornography. Yeah, 9-year-old child. Our youth today is exposed to challenges that may exceed their ability to cope. And make no mistake, there is no immunity. These problems are occurring even in the finest and most observant and most stable families. You read about kids at risk, all kids are at risk. Girls as well as boys. And we dare not underestimate the gravity of the situation. You know, at a time when wars were fought with swords and spears, a shield could be an adequate defense. When the weapons are grenades and bombs and missiles, shields are worthless. We have to have defenses corresponding to the aggression and to the weapons that are being thrown at us. It's interesting, the Talmud predicted at the end of the volume of Sota, the Talmud predicted what would happen when we got close to the ultimate redemption, how there would be a utter destruction of all semblances of morality and decency and honesty. And unfortunately, that prediction has become true. Alcohol, drugs, promiscuity, gambling become rampant, and our youth has been infected with these contagious conditions. People are desperately looking for solutions. There's only one major problem. They're looking for easy, simple solutions. If there isn't a magic pill that can set things straight, then at least there should be some techniques and strategies which parents can use to prevent youngsters from going astray and going into self-destructive behavior. Send the kid to a therapist to fix him. Or ship him off to Israel. Or at least tell us as parents what we should do. Sorry to tell you, folks, there's no magic pill. There's even no consensus on an effective magic management. And so the title of this talk is Securing the Home. And that's what we must do. Secure the home. But you might say, what do you mean secure the home? What do you want from me? Our home is run to the finest standards of Yiddishkeit. Yeah. Very kosher, and we observe Shabbos, and we have a sukkah, and then we have Shemurah Matzah on Passover. That's wonderful. That's very commendable. But that is not the highest standard of Yiddishkeit. The highest standard of Yiddishkeit is Avodas Hashem, serving Hashem, and Mesiras Nefesh, which is a total devotion to Hashem. Now, Avodas Hashem, Avoda means work. And today, Yiddishkeit requires very little work. When I was a kid, you had to get up before dawn to go to the farm to get kosher milk. And you want the chicken, you had to eviscerate the chicken and soak it and salt it. Then you had to make the chicken kosher. Talk to a young woman today about making a chicken kosher. She doesn't know what you're talking about. There were no takeouts. And there's nothing ready made. And supporting a family back in the 1930s and 1940s was a true Mesiras Nefesh, because there were very few jobs that did not require working on Shabbat. In the morning tefillah, we recite, or at least we should recite, the chapter of the Akedah, which is the patriarch Avram's willingness to sacrifice his son Isaac. And if we do so sincerely, then we're reminded that Yiddishkeit requires Mesiras Nefesh. And what is Mesiras Nefesh? It does not mean martyrdom. Mesiras Nefesh means expending heroic energy and making sacrifices for what one believes. A secure home. The most important element to provide security in a home for the child is a true shalom bayit, a real, sincere shalom bayis. True harmony between the parents. But this requires mesiras nefesh. This requires making sacrifice. This requires yielding one's wants and even one's needs in consideration for those of the spouse. As long as the husband and wife, or the wife, are self-centered, insisting on things being the way one wants them and disregarding the wants of the others, that's not shalom bayis. That's not a true harmony. And that's not a secure home. Where there is true love and mutual respect between husband and wife, the Shekhinah, the divine presence, is the divine spirit is present. And that brings in an element of kedusha, of holiness, that can help counteract the toxicity of the environment. A secure home is the home in which there is kedusha, in which everyone, each child, will feel so holy that one will not want to contaminate oneself with improper behavior. And so the answer is to bring kedusha into the home. And I said that parents have to give up their own desires in consideration for others. Furthermore, children never ask to be brought into the world. It's we as parents who bring them into this stress-ridden, chaotic, hectic world. And because we do so, we are obligated to give them the best opportunity to be happy and productive. Once you bring a child into the world, you forfeit your right. You forfeit the right to insist on your own wants. I don't care what the husband wants. I don't want to care what the wife wants. Right? The home has to operate on what is ultimately going to be best for the child. And parents have an awesome responsibility. The home must operate on what is ultimately healthiest and best for the child. You know that when a child feels that there's a strong bond between parents and that they truly love and respect and care for one another, the child has a feeling of security. Let me tell you something about the family that I knew best, my parents. My father was a very brilliant person, and because he used to visit the hospitals every day, he developed a very broad knowledge of medicine. And then later in life, when he was diagnosed with cancer of the pancreas and that it had spread to the liver, he knew exactly what that meant. And he said to me, because I was the doctor in the family, he said, for cancer of the pancreas, chemotherapy doesn't work, does it? I said, nope. He says, but you get a lot of unpleasant side effects from the chemotherapy. I said, yes. He says, you see, if chemotherapy could prolong my life, then I would have to deal with the unpleasant side effects. But if it's not going to do anything for me, just to suffer unpleasant side effect doesn't make any sense. He said, you're right. So, as long as we understand each other, that we're not going to bother with chemotherapy. Okay. Meanwhile, my mother's talking to the doctor. And the doctor says, There's not much we can do for the rabbi. We can try chemotherapy. Perhaps we can get an additional 3 months. And my mother said, 3 months? Why, for 3 days you'd have to do it. Every day of his life is precious. Of course you're going to do chemotherapy. And she came into my father's room and she read him the Riot Act. And after she left, my father said, you know, it's too bad that the doctor gave mother the wrong impression. It's not going to extend my life by 3 months. But you know something? If I refuse the chemotherapy, then when I die, mother is going to say, why didn't I put my foot down? Why didn't I insist? If I had insisted, he still might be alive. And she'll feel guilty for not having insisted. I don't want mother to feel guilty. So I'll take the chemotherapy. And then he said, there have been many things that I've done for mother. This will be one last thing. That was the kind of relationship that went on for the 52 years of their marriage. By the way, this was not a marriage based on love. Based on falling in love. Because my father saw my mother the first time after the chuppah. The parents had arranged a marriage. Each one had married a total stranger, but came to develop that kind of devotion and relationship. That's what I mean, a mutual love and respect. And that's the kind of shalom bayis that can provide security for a child to feel. And if there's a lack of true love and mutual respect, the child becomes anxious. And homes where there's spousal abuse, whether verbal, emotional, or physical, those are toxic to children. Yes, children need discipline. And parents should learn how to discipline their children. And parents should try to establish their authority, even in an age where authority has been eroded. But there are ways to do it. And again, a personal story. Some of you may have heard it. Well, too bad, you're going to hear it again. It's my favorite memory. As a child, I became something of a chess prodigy. Because you see, the shul was downstairs and we lived upstairs. And the people in the 1930s, these were first generation Russian immigrants. And most of them were hucksters, and they peddled for rags or scrap metal or whatever. And so late in the afternoon, they would put the horse in the barn. They used horses and wagons those days. They'd put the horse in the barn and come to shul and sit in the back of the shul and drink tea and play chess until mincha. Well, I sat there watching them, and I very quickly picked up the chess moves. And I began playing the old men. And I began beating them. And pretty soon, when I was 9 years old, there was no one in the shul that could beat me. Well, one Rosh Hashanah, we had a rabbi from Chicago spending Rosh Hashanah with us. And when my father was resting Rosh Hashanah afternoon, this rabbi comes over to me and he says, "Nu, you want to play chess?" I said, "It's Yom Tov." He said, "So? What's wrong with playing chess on Yom Tov?" "I guess nothing." "Okay." So I played him two games and I beat him soundly both times. Second night of Rosh Hashanah, the Shamus comes over to me and he says, "The rabbi wants to see you in his study." So I came in and, you know, it's not like today. I didn't come and say, "Hey, Dad, what do you want?" No. I just came in, stood silently, waiting to be acknowledged. And my father looked at a sefer, as though I didn't exist. And after a while, he looked up for a minute, and he said to me, you played chess at Rosh Hashanah? And I said, yeah, Rabbi so-and-so said you're permitted. He didn't say a word. He just looked back down into his sefer and almost imperceptibly shook his head. Almost imperceptibly, but just enough that I should notice. Yeah. And I got the message. What the rabbi said was right. Halachically, it's permissible to play chess on Yom Tov. But my father was telling me, Rosh Hashanah is not a game day. Yeah. So, what you did was not appropriate. Okay. So I was disciplined. Now, I can't leave until I'm dismissed. So I have to wait for my father to dismiss me and say, Gegesund der Heit, you know, go. So I stood there. He's looking back into his sefer. After a few minutes, he looks up at me. You beat him? I said, yeah, twice. Gegesund der Heit. You see the genius there? He had to discipline me and tell me that he did not approve of what I did, but I was not going to leave the room feeling negative about myself. Okay? That's the genius of good parenting. You have to discipline, but we have to find techniques in a way that we discipline the child and let a child feel self-esteem and feel dignity and not feel put down. Now, it's important when I talked about a complete harmony between parents. You know, it's possible that a shortstop and a first baseman may have had some differences between them. But when the ball is hit to the shortstop, he's going to make an accurate throw to the first baseman. Why? Because they both have a common goal to get the runner out. And when you have a common goal, then you cooperate fantastically. And if parents have a common goal to do what is ultimately best for the child's welfare, right, they can harmonize and some of their differences may melt away. You know, if a parent loses its temper or her temper, even if circumstances are fully justified, his child's security is endangered. Now, a parent may say, what can I do? I've got a short fuse, you know, and he push my buttons. That's an unacceptable excuse. Mesiras nefesh means making a sacrifice, making a heroic effort. And if you make a heroic effort, you can control your anger even if your buttons are pushed. That's what Mesiras Nefesh is all about. It's not martyrdom. I think that if we want our children to have the strength of Yiddishkeit, we have to make Yiddishkeit consumer friendly. Some children don't want to go to shul. I don't think I can blame them. Davening is supposed to be a sincere communication between self and Hashem, as David Bakwitz was talking about. But many minyonim go through the morning davening at a breakneck speed. No way that they can have any meditation at the rate they're going. All that's required to give tefillah a chance of being sincere with meditation is 5 or 10 minutes. Okay. Is it asking too much of a Mesiras Nefesh to spend 5 minutes more in shul? Furthermore, there is unfortunately an abominable practice of conversing during services, and our children see this. Conversing during services is a sin so great that the Shulchan Aruch said that there is no forgiveness for it. How can we expect our children to respect us as parents if we show such brazen disrespect to Hashem as to be in shul and when we're supposed to be relating to him, carry on a conversation with our neighbors. Okay, you'll say, our home is a very fine Shabbos-tika home. We observe Shabbos. Okay. It means we don't work on Shabbos, we don't cook on Shabbos. But there's more than Shabbos than that. Listen to the words of the prophet in Isaiah. If you restrain because of the Shabbos your regular habits, refrain from accomplishing your own needs on my holy day, if you proclaim the Shabbos a delight, the holy one of Hashem, the honored one, and you honor it by not doing your own ways, from seeking your needs or discussing the forbidden things such as business, then you shall be granted pleasure from Hashem, and I shall mount you astride the heights of the world and provide you the heritage of your forefather Jacob. That is observing Shabbos. You know something? If our children see us reading the weekend issue of the newspaper on Shabbos, or discussing finances, or what is worse, speaking Lashon Hara, defamatory talk, they miss the holiness of Shabbos. They don't grasp the Kedusha of Shabbos, and it's the Kedusha that's going to save them. You know, there's enough Torah works now, both in Hebrew and in English, that we can occupy ourselves fully with Torah discussions and Torah learning on Shabbos. And we can leave the reading of the weekend paper to Shabbos night or Sunday. Making Shabbos a delight means more than gefilte fish and roast chicken, more than chopped liver and chowd. These are fine, they're commendable. But they do not adequately express the love of Shabbos. Back in 1965, I was in Tzfat in Israel, and I met Rabbi Kaplan, the late Rabbi Kaplan, the rabbi of Tzfat. And he used to tell a story that when he was a youngster and he learned in the yeshiva of Mir, he left the house early one morning to go to the yeshiva to daven, and the husband was leaving the house to go to the market to buy provisions for Shabbos. And the wife shouted after him, "Don't forget, come back early, make sure you come back early." Well, Kaplan said that when he came home for lunch, the wife was standing at the door looking anxiously for the husband. And he said to her, "What's your problem? It's still several hours until Shabbos." So she said, "Well, I'll tell you why I'm anxious." She said, 7 years after our marriage, we had no children. And then we were blessed with a child, a little boy. But the child was not developing well. And I took him to the doctor, and the doctor said, "I want you to take him to the heart specialist in Vilna." So I took him to the heart specialist in Vilna. The specialist examined the child and said to me, "There's nothing I can do for the child. You'll just have to resign yourself to it." I came back to the hotel and I cried bitterly. And a woman asked me there why I was crying, and I told her. And she says, "You know what? On your way home, stop off in Radin and get a bracha from the Chofetz Chaim." So I did. Stopped off in Radin. But they told me that I can't go into the Chofetz Chaim because he was old and frail, and he wasn't, people were not being allowed in to see him. And my heart sank. But then I noticed a young man, a grandson of the Chofetz Chaim, who had been a student at Mir and used to room at our house when he went to yeshiva. So I went to him and asked him to use his influence to see if I could get in to see the Chofetz Chaim. And he did. And he brought me into the Chofetz Chaim. Chofetz Chaim was sitting over a sefer. And I broke down in tears. And the Chofetz Chaim asked me, "Why are you crying?" And I I told them about what they told me about my child. And the Chofetz Chaim said to me, "My child, dry your tears. Promise me that every Friday, by noontime, the table will be set l'kavod Shabbos. The table will be set ready for Shabbos. The candlesticks and the candles will be ready for lighting. And you'll be very careful to light them well before sunset." She said, "Well, of course, I promised." And when I came back home, I did what the Chofetz Chaim said. By noon Shabbos, the table was set for Shabbos. By noon Friday, the table was set for Shabbos. The candles were up. And the child started improving. And after the child developed a little better, I took him back to the doctor. And the doctor said, "Where were you? Did you go to Leipzig to the clinic?" I said, "No, we went to Vilna, like you told me. You're the heart specialist." He said, "Take the child back to Vilna again." Well, I went back to the heart specialist in Vilna, and he said, "This is not the same child you had here before." I said, "This is our only child." And he shook his head and he said, "You know, we doctors can sometimes do something to strengthen a weakened heart. I didn't want to tell you when I saw you last time that it was hopeless, that the heart was totally diseased. So, yes, we doctors can sometimes do something to strengthen a heart. But to take out a totally diseased heart and replace it with a totally healthy heart, only the Chofetz Chaim could do that." So she said to Rabbi Kaplan, "Now you understand why I'm anxious that my husband should come home early." The Chofetz Chaim's teaching is a wonderful segula, a wonderful charm, to convey to the family, to convey to the children how dear Shabbos is for us, how we want to prepare for it so much in advance, not to rush for the last 15 minutes, but Friday at noon, the house should be clean and ready for Shabbos. You know, if we bring that kind of kedusha into the house and the child absorbs that, the child begins to feel the kedusha of Shabbos. And when the child feels a kedusha, it strengthens him to avoid the toxic contamination that is so prevalent in our environment. You know, kids seek dangerous behaviors, probably because they're thrill seekers. And they're probably thrill seekers for the same reason that they take drugs. A happy child doesn't have a need for either. Doesn't have to take dangerous risks and doesn't have to take drugs. But you know, there's no way that you can make your child happy. All you can do is provide circumstances in which the child can develop his or her happiness. You can't make them happy. We have to give our children a real sense of a goal in life. Well, we all have goals in life. The goal is to succeed, the goal is to make money, the goal is to get a better car, the goal is to have a better house. Those are not ultimate goals. Those are all intermediate goals. But what is an ultimate goal? Something that we're living for, something that we'd be ready to die for. And that's the kind of goal that we have to give our children. A while back, during the presidency of Ronald Reagan, Nancy Reagan conducted a program, "Just Say No to Drugs." Remember that? Well, some social workers went around interviewing kids and asking them, "What do they think about Just Say No to Drugs?" And one 14-year-old young woman said, "Why? What else is there?" Do you realize what kind of tragedy it is for a young person to feel that there is nothing else to live for, and therefore to go for drugs. And we have to provide our children with a goal. And it's not enough to give them an education, it's to set an example that we have that kind of a goal, over and above the kind of success and material life that we want to have. You know something? Thank you. We are the beneficiaries of marvelous, marvelous advances of science and technology. And science and technology have made life so much more convenient, so much more comfortable. I remember what it was like in the 1930s. There was a lot of hardships then. Every major city had a tuberculosis hospital. Young people died of pneumonia. I had every childhood disease that there was. And when the weather was hot, you sweat bullets. And travel was difficult. I once went from Milwaukee to Los Angeles on the transcontinental train, 2 days and three nights. There's a lot of difficulties in those days that don't exist anymore. Do you realize that before 1940, the average life expectancy in the United States was under 50, and now it's 80? The wonderful thing that science has done for us. And when it's 100 degrees outside, we can sit in our room in perfect comfort with air conditioning. And yeah, you don't have to do so many things. You know, the kitchen has become a very easy place. I hope to make potato latkes this week. But not like my mother did with the grinder, with the scraper, with the rebars and like this, with the grater. No, we'll take out the food processor and very quickly. Well, I'm very grateful to science and technology that has made so many things possible. Oh, I remember my mother scrubbing the scrubbing board, the washboard like this, before she got the washing machine. And now it's the washing machine, the dryer. I mean, science and technology have really made life so much more comfortable. But the problem is that we've developed an attitude as looking at life, that life is supposed to be total comfort and convenience, and we don't know how to deal with stress. And if our kids are not going to learn how to deal with stress, they're not going to be able to cope. I think, look, there are some times when it's medically necessary to take medication, even a tranquilizer. But tranquilizers are the most widely prescribed medication in the world. And people are popping tranquilizers left and right, not because they're sick, but just because they're just a little bit edgy. What are we showing the kids? Don't ever accept any discomfort. Pop a chemical and you'll feel fine. That's an insecure home. You know, there were times during this recession where some parents sat with their children and explained to them what has been going on. It's age appropriate when the child is old enough to understand. Not to protect the child from the fact the father has lost his job and the family is in terrible straits, but to share with them the difficulties that they're going through and that everybody has to pull together. I think we have to give our children lessons in coping with stress, and the only way we can do that is by modeling it. That's the only way children will learn. So, science and technology are wonderful, but kids are getting a wrong impression as to what life is all about. There are, of course, some kinds of anxieties for which medications are necessary. But by the same token, when Dad comes home, takes off his jacket and says, "Rough day at the office. Oh, I gotta have a drink." That doesn't make him an alcoholic, but it sends a bad message. Rough day at the office, relax with alcohol. Right. Got to be careful what kind of messages we're sending into the kids. That takes away the security of the home. I don't know the reasons why some children deviate and go into self-destructive habits. There may be more than one reason. But one thing is absolutely clear for me. That the stronger the home is, the more secure the home is psychologically and emotionally. The more secure the bond is between parents. Right? The more secure the child will feel, and the better the child will be able to stand up against the insecurity in the rest of the world. It's not easy, but I don't think we have an option. Thank you for listening.